Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today began her career in publishing at the magazine Art Monthly in 1976. She was an editorial assistant. 2 years later, she joined Virago Press. She was basically the runner, but she got up to editing the famous Virago Modern Classics series. She went on to become editor-in-chief of Bloomsbury Publishing, where she spent 20 years. Her list of authors includes people like William Boyd, Margaret Atwood, Carmela Shamsi, George Saunders. She's been awarded honorary doctorates of letters from two British universities. She was elected an honorary fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 2017. Her latest venture is Silk Road Slippers, and she lives on a houseboat. Alexandra Pringle, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you.
It's just wonderful to have you here because you represent everything that is fabulous about publishing and particularly women in publishing. You've done so much for the industry and so much for the profile of not only women, but also for diverse writers within the industry. And it's just great to speak to you. Diversity is actually essential to who you are. Give us your family background.
Well, my father's Scottish, so that's half of me, but my mother was a Berber Moroccan Jew, and her family, the Afriads, were very ancient pre-Babylonian Berber Jews from the Ufrain, and they had caravans that went from Timbuktu to Essaouira, Mogador it was then called, carrying ostrich feathers and gum arabic and spices and so forth. And they did this extraordinary journey across the Sahara. And then my grandfather, by the time it was his business, it was cotton from Manchester, hence the British connection, and indigo from Pondicherry for the Tuareg, the blue men of the Sahara.
And so how much of this was present in your childhood?
It wasn't when I was very young. My mother was she hated her father, she hated her family. She left home when she was 17, and she joined the ATS when the war broke out, just like the Queen. And she drove officers around in cars. And she left it behind because her father wouldn't give her education. And she managed to go to art school after the war and get herself educated. Also, Britain was very, very anti-Semitic in the 1930s. And I think what she did was she passed. I was very interested at Virago in the Harlem Renaissance novels by women like Nella Larsen's Passing. And I think it was because I saw an echo of my mother in that. So we didn't know, none of us knew, until when I was 17, we went to Casablanca where my grandfather lived. He was dying. And he lay in bed and he said, "Give me an Arab and a camel and I will cross the Sahara." And we thought, this is really strange.
Was literature a big part of your childhood?
It was huge. I learned to read very, very late, and it was a huge struggle. But the minute it happened, it was like this extraordinary event in my life, and I just didn't stop. I was a terrible student. I failed exams all the time, but I read nonstop. And the defining book for me was my father came back from West Africa, where he worked in the summers, with a book which was Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe. And when I read that, I was 13 or 14, it was like the whole world turned on its axis and everything was different. And I think that book, probably more than any others, informed who I was as a publisher.
And so where did you go educationally from there?
Well, I failed to get into university. I didn't even get an interview. And my parents didn't know what to do with me. So they sent me off to a tech in Cambridge. It was then called Cambridge Tech, to do a secretarial course. And I found that they just started doing degrees. So they took me on to do one there, for which I was incredibly grateful. It's now, of course, called Anglia Ruskin University, but it wasn't even a poly in those days. So, yeah, my education is just pretty dismal, actually. But I got involved in a poetry festival in Cambridge at the end of my time there, and it completely lit me up. And I thought, this is what I want. I want to work with writers.
And you started working with writers at the very lowest level.
I did. Well, it's the way most of us begin in our careers. And I didn't have a particularly grand feeling about who I was because I was this failed person, you know, so I felt very lucky to have jobs. And my first job on Art Monthly, I was paid £5 a week for five mornings a week. And I had a room in Whitechapel with a lot of mice for £4 a week. And really, I was incredibly poor. Even then in the 70s, it was no money at all.
I mean, publishing hasn't come on very much in terms of salaries.
But a bit, a bit.
Yeah. So tell us that you then moved on to Virago, and this was the beginning of really what has become an absolutely stellar career.
Well, yes, it feels like that looking back, and I think, good God, was that really what I did? But it didn't feel like it then. You know, I was the office dog's body. I worked for Carmen Khalil, who was a genius, but she was a bully. And so it was terrifying and it was incredibly hard work. And because when you're bullied, you lose your sense of self. It was a long, slow haul. And I was very lucky because I had some incredible colleagues there, particularly Ursula Owen, who was co-founder with Carmen. And I learnt from both of those women. I felt I had two mothers, a good mother and a bad mother. But I learnt everything about how to publish. And I slowly got to start working on the modern classic series, and I'd read so many of those novels as a teenager because my mother had given them to me, and so it felt like a natural home for me. And I also worked on the covers, so I had a sort of art background too. And I loved learning about really particularly women's art from between the wars, little known. And so it was an extraordinary education. And I ended up being part of the management team, being editorial director and actually owning a little bit of the company.
Just for the benefit of listeners who may not know exactly what Virago is meant for, just tell us a little bit more about the company.
Well, Virago was founded to change the world. Not the small thing. But back then in the 70s and in the 80s, women had no force within publishing and literature. Most of the important works by women had gone out of print and were absolutely neglected. I mean, obviously, you know, there was Virginia Woolf and there was George Eliot, but there were huge rafts of extraordinary works by women. And the Modern Classic series was there to bring them back to life and to really change the canon, to reinvent it. And then, of course, Virago did lots of new books, really important new books about politics and history and women's lives today.
When you're editing a modern classic, when you can't collaborate with the author who may have died, how do you do that?
Well, the book is, the text is there. So what you're really doing is curating it. So you need to find somebody to write an introduction to give it its history, its place. And there were rafts of extraordinary women who worked with us. People like Susanna Clapp and Hermione Lee and Antonia Byatt and also men. Paul Bailey was a wonderful advocate of Elizabeth Taylor, who I think is a genius. So those people were very important to us. And of course, it was Michael Holroyd who really had the idea with Carmen for the classic series. So we had great brains feeding into it.
You then moved on to Hamish Hamilton.
Yes, I was editorial director there for 4 years.
And then you decided to take a completely different tack. You went off to be a literary agent.
Well, that was because I didn't suit corporate life and corporate life didn't suit me. By the time I went there, I was 36. I think I was too old and too stubborn and too political with a large P rather than a small P to take to corporate life. And I had an amazing time there. And I published Esther Freud's first novel, Hideous Kinky, and Tim Pierce's first novel, and people like Jenny Diskey. I had an amazing time and I learned a lot, but it wasn't for me. So I thought I have to reinvent myself. So I stepped out, which actually quite a few editors were doing at that time, and became a literary agent because although you're doing it from a different side of the business, you're using the same skills and the same passion, really.
And it's interesting because literary agents are all about the relationship you have with the author. But one thing I think that you're particularly known for in the industry is your wonderful personal relationships with authors who, for instance, like Esther Freud, who you published her first novel, however many years later, you're still great friends. People that you shepherd, that you nurture, that you take through their careers. And I guess being an agent gave you even more of an opportunity to do that.
It did. As an agent, it's very clear you're just on the side of the author. That's it. That's the beginning and the end of it. Although you need to work extremely well with publishers. As a publisher, it's much more complicated because you have to balance the needs of the publishing company and the needs of the author. So you're forever going between those two camps, and I hope getting it right most times.
Yeah. Then you decided that you wanted to go back to publishing?
I didn't decide. Bloomsbury came to me. Liz Calder came to me. We had a lunch and she said, we were talking about an author and she said, actually, that's not really what I want to talk about. I'm going to retire quite soon and we're looking for somebody to replace me as editor-in-chief and would I think about it? And I actually took 4 months. I don't know why I took more than 4 minutes because it was a dream job, but I knew it was the most important career decision of my life. And I also felt very responsible to my authors who I represented because it's such an upheaval if that central person changes. But I felt that it was, for me, Bloomsbury had everything I wanted if I were to be a publisher again. It's independent, but it was of a good size. It had a wonderful culture to it. And I just thought, I have to do it.
Mm. And you did. And Bloomsbury is now positioned as one of the top publishers in this country.
Well, it's a wonderful place. It's extraordinary, I think.
Tell us about some of the authors that you've worked with there.
Oh, goodness, there have been so many. Some of them I took with me as I went. So Esther came with me. Carmela Shamsie, who I'd met when she was a student in America, and I was agent for her first novel, and she came with me. So that was like a sense of my family moving with me. But then I was, one of the very early writers I took on was Abdulrazak Gurnah, and I with a novel By the Sea, which I loved so much. And I worked with him for 20 years. And I have to say that towards the end of my time at Bloomsbury, I had begun to think that his real recognition, he was very loved and respected and well reviewed, but he's a master. And I felt that that wasn't properly recognised. And in fact, he was overlooked for the Booker Prize with his most recent novel, Afterlives. And I'm very superstitious about prizes and I'm pretty good at dealing with it. But with that one, I was devastated when he wasn't longlisted. And there was an article in The Guardian about reinventing the canon of black literature with lots of amazing black writers writing about the history of black literature. No one mentioned him. And I ranted on social media, which I never do. And 4 days later, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. So so that was incredible. Yeah. And he's a writer who I admire more than I can possibly say.
And of course, you published George Saunders, who won the Booker.
Yes. And Bloomsbury published George Saunders from the very, very beginning. And he wrote these fantastic collections of short stories, I have to say, none of which sold at all. And I remember having to fight quite hard to keep on with him because of that, the dismal sales. But again, he was so important. I thought he was at the centre of what we were doing at Bloomsbury. And then he came up with Lincoln in the Bardo, his first novel, and it won the Booker Prize.
How do you go about shaping the profile, the ethos of a publishing company?
I think that a publishing company is entirely based on the taste of the editors. And everything comes from that. And I think a good editor has to be led by their taste and their belief, not what they think the market is, not what they think the world wants. And so running the editorial department, I felt my mission really was to hire the right editors. And often they would start very young as assistants and grow up through the company. And what I feel is that editors need to grow their taste, but also their confidence in that taste. Because if you don't have that, you get knocked back so often when you publish a book that you will lose heart and you just lie down and give up. So helping to give confidence to my editors was important and also have confidence in my own taste.
And as you say, it becomes like a family. What about your own family at this point?
Well, I have one son. And I think that if I hadn't had such an absorbing and difficult job, wonderful job, but one that took so much out of me, I would have probably liked to have had 5 children, but I have one. And he's a journalist. He's head of news on Middle East Eye. And we travel together a huge amount. And he's the absolute joy and light of my life. And then there are 2 stepdaughters. One really sadly died, Nell Gifford, who ran a circus. And I met her and her sister, Clover Stroud, when they were in their early 20s. And they are a great joy of my life. And they've given me the larger family that I would have liked to have had. And Clover is, of course, a fantastic writer, a great writer of memoir. And she and I are running writing workshops together, which is lovely. So it's like family. You know, my son is a writer and an editor, and my stepdaughter is a writer.
You then made the momentous decision to move on from Bloomsbury.
Yes.
Why was that?
I've always felt that it's important to leave a company before you're too old, before you get stale in any way, because companies have to reinvent themselves. And it's your duty to do that. And I decided that I should do it before I hit 70. So that's
Can I just tell listeners, she looks 45. But, you know, carry on.
So I thought it was going to be very painful. But I was incredibly lucky because before I left Bloomsbury, an ex-colleague of mine, Faizah Khan, came to me and said she'd had an idea for a company which she wanted to have with friends. And the mission was really to do extremely good work and to have a lot of fun. And so I was one of the friends, and the others are Nesreen Malik, the amazing Guardian journalist, and Alex von Tunstelman, the historian and screenwriter.
Who's a frequent contributor here at Monocle.
She is. And so the four of us became Silk Road Slippers.
Now, let's go back to that, because it almost takes us full circle back to your ancestors. What is Silk Road Slippers?
So Silk Road Slippers is a company, and by the way, our logo, which is a picture of a man on a camel with a gun, is my family's trademark from the 1920s. So it really does go full circle. And we are a sort of triangle. So on the most sort of frivolous point of our triangle, we all travel a lot. We're passionate about traveling, and we buy beautiful things and we sell them on Instagram and on our website. Another point of that is a book club, which we run, and it's online, and we interview authors, we have conversations with them. Everything that we do is about storytelling, and it's about going out into the world. It's about other cultures, other countries, other places. And then the third point, which we're incredibly excited about and which we see as being the sort of really the central thing, is we are running writing masterclasses in this beautiful tiny boutique hotel in Marrakesh, which tragically has been devastated by this earthquake. Luckily, not Marrakesh, which is not that badly affected, but up in the Atlas where my family come from. But obviously, you know, we want to do our bit to, you know, help that country, which is also my country, of course. So here I am going back to my ancestral land in Morocco. Each course is a week long, and we have so the four of us do the granular teaching, very intense, but also lots of fun. We want everything in life, I think, should be hard work and lots of fun at the same time.
Yeah,
that's how I've led my life all the way through. And so in November, the first week, we have star guests. So we have a star guest who comes in for 3 days, is Shehan Kuintalaka, who won the Booker Prize last year. And the next week is Abdulrazak Gurnah, obviously the Nobel Prize winner. So we have these astonishing star guests, and groups of, we're between sort of 12 and 14, 18 people, depending. And we will all be together, and we will help people with their writing. We'll run these workshops and also, you know, spend time in the beauty of Morocco.
Tell us a little bit about the venue, because I know that they're very involved, the people that own it are very involved with the development and help of Moroccan society.
Yes, they're very unusual. They're a married couple, Marianne Loum Martin, who is from Senegal. She's actually the only black African woman hotelier in that bit of the world. And she has this extraordinary aesthetic. She has created these interiors which are to die for. And her husband, Gary Martin, who is an ethnobiologist. So he's created these beautiful gardens, but he's also founded the Global Diversity Foundation, which does a huge amount of work in Morocco. And of course, they were there on the ground when the earthquake happened and able to get aid out immediately. Mm. So it's lovely to have them as a partnership.
Do you think in workshops such as the ones you're running, or indeed any workshop, people can be taught to write?
I do. As I've worked as an editor for 45 years, so I know that. You know, I have worked with very young writers and also much older. I like working with people in their 40s, 50s and 60s who are starting to write. And people have this, if they want to do it enough, if they have this will to do it, they can be given tools. They can also just be helped by conversations to give inspiration. I love I love what we call structural editing, which is like taking the character's a novel or taking somebody's life, whatever it is they're writing about, and picking up the people in it, the characters, talking about the narrative, the structure. There's so much that comes out, and often I don't know what I'm going to say when I start those conversations. And things come up, and it's like a kind of electricity in the room. But there are also useful tools. They're literally tips of writing that people don't think about. And on our Instagram feed on Silk Road Slippers, we give writing tips, and people love them. And they can be very simple and incredibly useful.
What about your own writing?
I write, I do bits of journalism and so on when I'm asked, and I always enjoy that. And I think it's very good for me because I think it's good for editors to write as well, to see how hard it is, because my God, it is hard. And there might be something in the back of my head, but it's too early for me to talk about it.
Oh, there's got to be a memoir. I'm very, very, that's got to come out very soon. We've got to talk about living on a houseboat. Oh. It's the most beautiful boat.
It is lovely. It is so wonderful. I've lived on it for 23 years. And it's one of those things that is you're part of nature. The boat goes up and down 20 foot twice a day because the tides on the Thames are enormous. It's in the Thames and Chelsea. And as you've seen, it's one big space upstairs, and then the bedrooms and bathrooms are downstairs, and it gets lots of light. And of course, there are lots of birds, and there's the water and the sounds of the water. And the light comes and goes. It's completely magical. And after a hard day's work, stepping back onto the boat, it's like going on holiday, of course, like going into a kind of paradise. But tragically, our boatyard is, we are being forced out by the people who own the boatyard. And they're refusing to renew our licenses, which means the boats will be worth nothing when we leave, when we come to the end of our licenses. So it's an absolutely terrible thing that's happened, because not only will we have to leave at the end of our license, but we'll get no money for the boats that were worth quite a lot of money about 6 years ago.
I mean, just walking through to the harbour where your boat yes. is a few weeks ago, I noticed how ugly and how overdeveloped that whole area had become.
Yes.
And this is just a plan to do that again.
Yes, yes. The man is bringing in giant boats that he rents out for huge sums of money, and he's getting rid of all the higgledy-piggledy. It's an old historic bit of London. It's been there since the 1930s, and it will be changed beyond anything. And the residents, you know, will be left destitute too. It's a terrible thing. It's like a, I don't know, as Rackman was back then.
Yeah, and nothing to be done?
We don't know. I mean, we've been fighting for years, and we just don't know. We hope that maybe people will take up the campaign, you know.
Well, you're fighting for years, but you've also, of course, been doing all of this other stuff at the same time.
Yes.
And the most exciting of those right now, apart from the memoir that I know you're going to write, is Silk Road Slippers. You touched very briefly on the fact that you sell things on your Instagram account.
Yes.
And I think this comes out of one of the great perks of being in the publishing industry, or adjacent to it, as I am, is going to foreign festivals.
Yes. I love that. I've been so lucky this year because, particularly, I think, because of Abdul Razak getting the Nobel. So there are festivals. I've been to the Jaipur Festival every year for almost the second or third year it started. But this year, it's kicked off with going to the Dhaka Festival in Bangladesh, and then Jaipur, and then I went to one in Kerala, and then Lahore, which I love. I've been to the Lahore Festival a number of times.
It's a fantastic festival, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I love it to pieces.
But what you're doing there, of course, is going shopping.
Going shopping. So I interview writers, which I love doing, as do you. You know, it's such a joy doing that. I'm going shopping because I love shopping, and I love beautiful things, and I particularly adore things like antique embroideries. I buy beautiful cushion covers from the Swat Valley. And they're pieces of art. They're works of art. And they tell stories. That's one of the things I love, is bringing things back. And now, of course, my boat has got too much in it, so I can now buy things for other people, not just for myself. Mm. I can't buy anything more because there's not a single inch I have left in my own boat.
But in terms of, for instance, the jewellery, I love the sort of diamond slices.
Yes. I love the diamond slices. I've loved those for years, and I've taken authors to buy them when I've been in Jaipur. And now, of course, we can bring them to London and sell them. And they are lovely because they're like ancient Mughal jewellery, you know, with I don't like stones that are overcut, and these aren't. They're just like beautiful, clear slices of diamond, and each one is different, and they have little bits of carbon in them, and you feel they have this sort of ancient world with them.
Well, as you say, I mean, it's all about storytelling from your career in publishing to your workshops that you'll be running, your writers' retreats, but to these beautiful pieces that all have history folded into them.
Everything is about storytelling, I think, and that's the heart of publishing and the heart of these workshops, these masterclasses that we're running. We're so excited about them. And next year we'll be doing two in February and two in November. And my stepdaughter Clover is going to do a life writing one. And we have Carmela Shamsi and Maggie O'Farrell lined up as well. So that, I think, is, for me, the most exciting thing that we have ahead.
Absolutely. So anybody can come?
They just
book a place? What is the criteria?
They need to want to write, that's all. And they need to go onto our website, which is silkroadslippers.com. And there's all the information there. And they will be wonderful, exciting adventures.
Alexandra, thank you so much for talking to me. And thank you also for all you've done in the world of publishing and for all that you are yet to do. I'm sure there's many more chapters to come.
Thank you.
That was Alexandra Pringle, and each of the Silk Slippers Writing Masterclasses will take place over 6 days. The first one is between the 12th and the 14th of November at the gorgeous Janaine Tamsner Hotel in Marrakesh in Morocco. For more information, visit www.silkroadslippers.com. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the show's producer, Tamsin Howard, and to our engineer, Callum McLean. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.